Anyway, first of all, welcome.
Hello.
I have as long as you have, roughly, right? Okay. Why don't you sit on the edge here or something? So, this is our recording device and so forth. And so, how was PLOS?
PLOS is good. It's always good to go to PLOS.
So what were you talking about there?
So I gave them a talk about F1000 because a lot of them hadn't heard. Well, they'd heard of us, didn't know exactly what we did. Sorry, I've got a camera in here somewhere. I'm just looking for
it. Well, don't panic.
Yeah, okay.
We've got all the time in the world.
All the time in the world.
Right. So tell us about...
So I was filling them in on what we do, what we've been doing, and our future plans. There we go. No, that's not it. I'll have a look in a minute.
Right, so first of all, explain the difference between the scientist and faculty of 1000.
Right, so the scientist is now the magazine of faculty of 1000.
Right.
So we're using it for slightly...
Are we recording?
Are we recording? Oh, yes.
Okay.
So we're using it for slightly more light-hearted, if you like, content. We're driving the scientific content of the scientist from Faculty 1000. So the articles we evaluate, we use those as a basis for the scientific discussion within the scientist. We still, in the scientist, produce report on news. We interview people, interview scientists. We get opinion pieces. But we're bringing it more in-house, so it's our magazine, it's our community focus, if you like.
So it's very much the organ of the Faculty of 1000 rather than the scientist sponsors the faculty.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
We publish it now. Yeah.
And right. And I have seen reports in the Scientist. I must admit, I don't read anything. Right. So you shouldn't feel unhappy. I don't read that and so on. But. Tell me about the faculty then. I mean, it's been going, several years?
It's been going nearly 10 years now.
Yes.
Started off as Faculty of 1000 Biology, and about 2005, 2006, we opened up Faculty of 1000 Medicine. And what we're doing now, and what I worked on last year, was merging the two sites, so there's more fertilisation. You know, it's almost artificial to separate biology and medicine in
a lot of disciplines.
Not all of them. You know, things like ecology doesn't have much of a medicine overlap. But we're bringing it back together into one site. And last Friday, we opened up an internal beta. And it looks pretty nice. We have a new website. We're going to preview it to anybody who's interested in a couple of weeks' time, and at the end of the month. And then at the end of October, we'll switch off the old sites and switch everyone over to the new site. So, Faculty of 1000, what we do is have about 10,000 scientists and medics around the world who, as they read the literature, find interesting papers. They write short evaluations, anywhere between 50 and about 300 words. They'll give the paper they're evaluating a score, and we publish that. We publish comment on the best articles that you can find in biology and medicine. Currently, depending on the discipline, between 1 and 2% of biomedical papers make it into Faculty 1000. So we're essentially a filter for, you know, the best that's going on. Interesting stuff.
Okay. I'm just going to stop here to check various things. First of all, is the recording level coming through okay?
I can just double check. I think it's okay.
And secondly, we've got this grill, and if necessary, we might have to... Right, so just to resume our conversation, you were telling us about the Faculty of 1000, which is a group of actually 10,000 scientists who
and medics
who read and filter the literature for other people, and your revenue is based on a subscription model.
That's right. Yes.
So, you know, where does this fit into people's subscriptions into journals and things like that? Is it generally done on a personal basis, or do you have institutional subscribers?
We used to offer personal subscriptions, but there's a lot of hassle to set those up. You know, it's as much work to set up a personal subscription as it is an institutional subscription.
Yeah.
And in fact, given the pricing model, you get about six people with personal subscriptions at one institute, and it's cheaper for the institute to take them. So we're pushing the subscriptions, the institutional subscriptions, rather than personal now. Right. I mean, we do make exceptions, and our faculty members, if they're in a non-subscribing institute, will set up a free subscription for them. But yeah, it's mostly institutional based.
Right. And we'll get on to some of the Pantheon oriented things in a minute. But how do you find recruiting your faculty? Do they get rewarded for this in some way, or do they give it altruistically, or what?
It's altruistically, it's a contribution to the community. I mean, personally, I'd love to pay the faculty for it, and then, you know, we can. The problem is that would be horribly expensive. So we have up to about 1,500 evaluations per month coming through. You know, you just do the maths. If you were going to pay a decent amount of money, there's no way we could afford that.
Of course not.
Yeah. So we rely on goodwill, but in return, we actually give faculty members exposure. Now, with the scientists on board, we're doing that more often. So we feature faculty scientists.
Right.
We're thinking of setting up a blogging platform so they can write and get exposure that way. We also, there's a lot of kudos associated with being a faculty member. People put it on their CVs,
right?
For example. And because all the faculty are appointed or recommended by their peers, it's a kind of peer recognition that to be a faculty member, you know, it's a given. You're doing good science, your opinion is respected. So,
we
give away freebies. You know, people who are productive get a certificate, they get mugs, they get t-shirts, they get things like that.
And the ranking evaluation that your faculty give to papers, is that cited by some people as evidence of the value of their research?
It is, actually, yes. I know that authors get very excited when they get evaluated by Faculty of 1000, they put it on their CVs, and in fact some of the granting agencies are really interested in using those to assess the quality of research out with the, you know, citation-based metrics.
Yes, so I mean, I'm not a fan of metrics, although I haven't a better solution to it, but one of the problems must be that there's a certain arbitrariness about it, that whether your paper is filtered through depends on the particular people in that field who might read it and comment on it or whatever.
That is a risk, and I'm sure we miss important and interesting papers just because, you know, we are growing the faculty. We started with 1,000, hence the name, you know, back in 2002, 2003. We brought in Faculty of 1000 Medicine, and we grew the faculty up to about 4,500 members. What we've done over the last year or two is introduce a new scheme where each faculty member, and these faculty members are, you know, senior scientists and medics within their field, they're group leaders, they're heads of department. And what they can do is recruit an associate faculty member now, who helps them identify and write the evaluations. And as part of that, we ask the associate faculty members to nominate two journals, a generalist journal and a specialist journal within their field, and we send them the tables of contents for those journals, and we try and provide access when we can if they don't have access to that journal. And so in that way, we're actually scanning the literature in a more systematic way. We're currently covering about 800 core journals, and we've got an equal number of associate faculties as faculty, so we've got nearly 10,000 people.
Good. And just remind me who the founders of this were.
So it was Vitek Traxas.
I thought it was Vitek.
Yes, it's his idea to start with. Mm. So Vitek, as you know, set up, he invented open access, essentially.
Well, he invented a commercially sustainable model of open access.
I think that's fair. Yes. So Biomed Central was
yes.
set up
Indeed.
By him. Yeah. That spearheaded open access, and it's doing very well.
Good. Okay, let's now review what you'd like to talk to us about in terms of open data and so on. Do you have a set of questions you'd like to ask?
I've got some questions here. I'd actually like to record you answering some of them.
Absolutely. Everything is... just to make it clear, the recording is done on the basis that it's CC BY, so that anybody can use it for any purpose, but they must attribute it and so on. So if you want to take this and make a commercial offering out of it, you're free to, but of course we have the right to do our own thing with to fork it and do
absolutely
whatever.
Absolutely. I have some basic questions just to introduce the whole idea, which will be, I intend making editing a video, putting this on the website.
So so explain what your basic idea is first of all then.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry,
you said you want to ask some questions as part of your basic idea.
No, sorry, of your idea. Idea behind the Pantone principles,
yes.
How it got started. And then I'd like to go into things, some of the issues. How do you get people involved? How do you get scientists to actually commit to the idea of sharing the data? And what are the caveats? How do you overcome those problems? And another couple of questions.
Okay, that's fine. Start that now. And I'm happy to answer the questions as they come up, if that's
sure.
The easiest way.
Sure.
And I will talk for about 3 minutes or something of that sort. And,
yeah.
The idea about that is that we can then put them out as reasonable-sized chunks in audio, because we're not going to be able to transcribe it. Unless you...
I wish I was able to do that. Yeah. Okay. So I'll first ask you how you got involved and how it got started. Okay.
It meaning open data.
The whole open data, which led to the Pantone principle.
Hang
on, once I'm recording.
Okay.
Okay. So how did you get involved in open data, and where did it start from?
Right, well, I'm a crystallographer by background, but I've also been very inspired by Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the semantic web. And I see the possibility of building intelligent or slightly intelligent machines which are able to help scientists. So my ultimate goal is to build a small amount of artificial intelligence into machines to bring us to the next level of science. Now, in that, I needed data, and I thought that I would be able to get data from the literature, and I thought that I would be able to pull this out just as a matter of course. What I found was that although there was some data in the current literature, it wasn't necessarily obviously available for reuse, so that some publishers didn't put the data out, and that other publishers stamped it with their copyright. Now, I believed naively, well, not naively, as many people do, that data is not copyrightable, and so I raised this point and assumed it would go away, that people say, well, we didn't mean to copyright the data or whatever, but it hasn't gone away, right? And as a result, I started looking into open data about 2006, I think, and I felt the best way to do this was to write a Wikipedia page to gather together what the community thought about open data. So I launched a page called Open Data. I tried to find current uses of it and historical uses, and it was virtually unknown, so that there was a little bit in Open Geoscience, and they've been one of the earliest ones to explicitly talk about open data, and there was a little bit from John Bosak about how when we gave people data, then it was our data, and when we were using web tools for telling people about ourselves, we had a right to our data, and so forth. But generally, data was not something that people worried about at all, and that's as little as 4 years ago. So I created this page. I tried to find other people. Keith Jeffrey from Rutherford gave some quotes and so on. I pulled that together, and then I used that as the basis for an article which I wrote for, I'm trying to remember what it was called, it was It wasn't scholarly publishing, it was one of Serial's review on open data. There was a joint article on open access, and I wrote on open data. So that helped me get my ideas together at that stage. By that time, which I think was about 2008, the idea was getting a bit more currency, and so we're beginning to find people just naturally putting the words open and data together. So I'll explain a bit about what we mean by open data, but it's probably a good time to take stock.
Yes, that's fine. I've got another question, actually.
Sure, exactly.
So when you say, 4 years ago, you thought the problem would go away, was that because no one was actually thinking in terms of open data, or was there active pushback? People were resistant to the idea?
I think, first of all, the problem hadn't been articulated. Then I think we find that, and I must make it clear that every discipline is different, so that what happens in astronomy is different from material science. And in fact, there was a meeting, which I think was in 2007, run by Science Commons in Washington, where what happened was that there was a presentation by Andrew Lawrence, professor of physics at Edinburgh, and he made it clear that even in physics there was a wide variety of different approaches. One was that the astrophysics people would share everything because they had to. You can't do astrophysics unless you're getting things from different regions of the sky, different wavelengths, different historical periods and so on. You need all this to make sense of it.
Biologists have been doing this for a while without realising it, because the PDB, for example, is completely open. You have to put your data in there as a precondition to publishing now.
Indeed, and I actually can trace for myself many of the roots of this back to the crystallographic community. So one of the inspirations of this was J.D. Bernal in 1965, who proposed a crystallographic data factory for the world, and also put in place the Cambridge Crystallographic Database, as it became, which was one of the first places for systematic abstraction of the literature into data. There'd been abstraction for bibliography for a long time, but it is one of the first. Probably, in fact, things like chemical abstracts predated it, and there was a certain amount of data there, but in terms of concentrated data, crystallographic database was probably one of the first. The International Union of Crystallography then set the scene by I shouldn't use the word aggressively, but pretty determinedly requiring journals to require its authors to make their data public when they published a paper, so that the publication could be replicated. So I think it was in the early 70s that they started engaging with journals, asking them to make sure that the structure factors were available and that the coordinates are available, which are the things which are required to replicate crystallographic calculations. Not all journals were happy with this. I think Nature was one of the last, in fact, to accede to this. Probably by the, I would think something like the 76, something like that, I think most of the journals are actually publishing crystallographic data. So that set the ethos for it. And at the same time, because of what had happened with the small molecules in Cambridge and the PDB, that really set the scene. Though I also remember that it was fairly early on from the discovery of the value of sequence alignment that people started publishing sequences and depositing sequences. So, late 70s, early 80s, the scene was set for, the systematic recording, mandatory recording of scientific data to support experiments, and also the value of reuse was very early on shown with both the crystallography and the sequence data, because it was seen how important it was to piece together the different bits that people could use for systematic exploration of the effects.
So biologists have been doing this for some time now.
But indeed.
You're asking for more. What kind of data could I submit if I was...
Well, as I say, it depends very much on the discipline. It's agreed that high energy physics has its own way of doing things, and that it wouldn't make much sense for people to determine ask for the raw data out of the Atlas machine, because they haven't enough bandwidth to get it, let alone the question of interpretation. So what we actually see now is a concentration on a pipeline of data whereby we start with raw data, we then have perhaps clean data. It depends on the domain as to what particular term you use. Cleaning doesn't mean that you're fudging it, and that's one of the things that we have to do when we look at the concern about climate data, for example. We have to make it clear that cleaning is a necessary as well as a legitimate part of data analysis. It's things like applying calibrations, things like smoothing out noise, things of that sort, which are required to make sure that the data are usable in the next stage. Then we often go on to something called filtered data, where the data which are necessary for a particular experiment or interpretation have been selected, and again that is not an arbitrary selection to support somebody's view, it's a necessary selection to define the question that you're trying to answer.
How do people respond when they come across the whole idea of open data, or you say you should be doing this with your data set making it available?
Again, it depends on the discipline. It happens that about an hour ago I got a very recent and very valuable report from Rin Nesta, that's R-I-N and N-E-S-T-A, who are groups in the UK which have been looking at data reuse, and they have looked at six different groups who have been interested in data sharing and the principles involved. And I can't go through all of them from memory, but certainly there was a bioscience group, David Shotton's group from Oxford was talking about image reuse, Jeremy Frey from Southampton and his group, Simon Culls, were talking about crystallographic reuse, and there were four or five other groups involved. So I would say that that's a very valuable report for people to read on this topic, and an hour or two later I could be more authoritative on it.
I'm just going to take a break there.
Right. So,
that's cool.
Technically, how's that going, Richard? Is that going okay?
No, that's fine. Yeah. Right. I can show you, if you like, what this looks like.
Well, this is tremendously valuable.
So what I can probably do is give you a copy of the raw file, but
right.
I'll edit it down to 3-minute chunks.
That would be lovely, purposes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that's quite good.
It's very good, right.
Yeah.
That's really valuable. I didn't realise when you started recording that it was a video recording.
Oh, right.
Mainly because it's a little bit it's a little bit sort of artificial for you asking questions and holding it.
Is
there.
It?
And
it's
it threw me originally, whereas I wouldn't be thrown by a static video
sure.
camera.
If I'd been on the ball, I'd have brought the tripod and just had
and
it.
Do we have a tripod?
I don't have one with me, no. No. I can act as a surrogate tripod if it would be useful.
That might work, actually, if you don't mind.
Where do you want me to look? That's it.
It helps to look into the camera.
I've been doing that on a moderately regular basis.
I mean,
so it's
it
probably. I'm quite happy with you to do it.
That's fine. It looks like the person watching this wants to feel they're interacting with you, not.
Indeed. Yeah. I agree.
Just one question. Can I ask how you're finding the light? Because when I'm taking pictures, I'm finding maybe a bit of light from the window.
It seems pretty good.
Blinds,
I mean, this is. I mean, this is. beautiful little machines, but they're not very good in low light. So this is
actually okay. In that case, fine. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I'd leave the light on. So, are you happy about the way the questions are going?
Yeah, that's good. Really good. I've got a lot of things there. So where did we get to? That's right. How people's
response?
Can you
actually get me a drink, please?
Yes. What would you like?
I normally have a lime and lemonade. Do you need to type anything? Or
I'm just making brief notes of when you're talking about the question, so I know when roughly when the starting, but it's
okay. Showing. Well, if you
wait until it gets back, I guess. Yeah. No, that's going well.
Right.
So it's building up. Quite
okay.
Nicely
so.
Into the
story. So off you go. Okay.
Well, wait till it gets your drink, and then you can.
Well, they'll bring it through.
Okay.
Okay.
Bang on the right.
Bang on the door.
Hello?
Just be brave, shout.
Hello?
Hi there! I can't whistle, that's my problem. Oh well.
I wouldn't.
Grab on when you're next.
Okay.
It's just if I continue talking for this amount of time, I
of
need...
Of course, well, we'll stop any...
Yeah,
and if you
that's
want
okay.
To
on you, go. Let's go and see how it goes.
Yeah, okay. So we got that... Okay, I'm going to ask a little bit about science funded from non-public sources, and that's what kind of opposition there is.
Okay.
So for the most part, we're talking about science that's being funded from public sources, grant money, and so forth. How have you had any opposition to open data from scientists who are funded privately?
No, but then I probably haven't engaged with them a lot. On the other hand, I see no problem at all. I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry in Glaxo. There's absolutely no requirement for a company to publish its data as a matter of course, so that its competitors can see it, right? What we have to avoid is partial publication, where somebody publishes something because they want the academic credit from it, but they don't release the full data because they want to keep that secret. Now, that does lead to bad science.
In what way?
Well, it's possible to publish just the overall account of an experiment. You know, well, we calculated these properties, but not to put in the parameters that you used or the data set it was operated on or whatever. I mean, I am on the editorial board of the Journal of Chemoinformatics, which is a BMC publication. And in Chemoinformatics, a lot of the research belongs to is created by pharmaceutical companies or by collaborations between companies and academia and so on. Now, sometimes the data sets that are used are confidential, and the authors sometimes put in, well, we took 50,000 compounds, but we can't give the exact structures, but they were of this type. Now, I don't regard that as satisfactory. I feel that if you are talking about data in a publicly visible publication, then you've got to give all of the details and you've got to decide how important confidentiality is as opposed to how important publication in a peer-reviewed journal is. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, I want to get the credit for publishing it, but I don't want to tell you actually what the details were because they're confidential. And this is not just a sort of academic issue. These papers could be used as justification for, let us say, the efficacy or the safety of particular compounds in drug preparations and so forth. So we have to get papers in the academic sphere as transparent, regardless as to where the material came from or the motivations of people.
Sure. So something you mentioned there was competition, and I know a lot of academic scientists, publicly funded scientists, feel that if they give away too much, it would, you know, do them harm in the race for grants and whatnot. Have you got any carrots you might offer these people?
Well, there is. We can start with the sticks, right?
Yeah.
Which is that there's an increasing public ethic that publicly funded research should be publicly available. There are ethical reasons for this, there are moral reasons, and there are pragmatic ones. So if we start with the ethical ones first, that is that it's perfectly reasonable for a granting body to expect that its research is published as widely as possible and to put that condition on the grant holder. There are moral reasons, which is that much of this research benefits humanity as a whole directly. I would say that all scholarship benefits humanity indirectly, but there are areas like medicine, like climate and so on, where I think there's actually a moral imperative to make the material fully publicly, transparently available, and one shouldn't say that it is restricted to a small number of people. When it comes to so those are the pushes that there are, and there are an increasing number of sticks employed to do that, and I think we will see that in the future people who don't publish their data will find it harder to get grants. On the current side, there's no question that in some disciplines sharing data leads to fairly tangible results. It leads to more collaborators, and more collaborators can lead to more papers and more exciting papers. That is, if you take papers as a metric of success, which I don't necessarily, because I think that there are many other metrics which are as valuable, and data reuse, which we may come on to, is one of them. But that sharing your data means that people use their data, they do science with that data, and they will give you credit for having made the data available. And I think that the chain of reasoning may be a bit long for some people and they need to see examples, but I'm sure that we will see increasing amounts of that where you can say, if your data is available, more people will use it and your work will be more highly valued. We already know that in some cases, making your papers open access leads to greater citations. Heather Pivovar has shown that if you make your data available, you're likely to get more citations and so on. So that, although this may not be true in all fields at the moment, or it may not be provably true, I think it is likely to be a generalisation that's possible.
That's excellent. Thank you. So, how are people getting on with? No need to record that on there. It's fine. With, you know, you talked about credit, and you're talking about citing data. How are people getting on with DOIs for data? Is that taken
right.
off?
Cause are you not recording that?
No, that's fine. I've got plenty of material there.
Oh, so, I see. Right. So you okay? So we'll continue recording.
Yeah, I mean this
on
is
right, the out of blank deal.
No public comment.
Don't they know who he is?
Can I have orange instead?
So orange and
lemonade and
lemonade orange.
Fizzy, yes, whatever.
Okay, so.
Right. Now I'm completely thrown.
DOIs.
DOIs, okay, yeah. Yes. Yes, I think that there's a critical mass now of people who understand DOIs for data and are pushing them. There is a data site project which is looking at doing this. I'm on the board of the advisory board of PubMed Central, UK PubMed Central, sorry, and this is looking at data site so that I think this will happen.
Okay.
Now, there are clearly problems. The data will throw up a whole load of technical problems that have to be solved. You cannot move just from open access to open data in a straightforward manner. So if you have a data set, you've got, first of all, what is the data set? It may reside in more than one place. When is the data set? You know, is it updated daily? Are there different versions of it and so forth? So what is it that you're citing and so forth? And these are not easily solved, and we will require, you know, a new generation of technology to manage them in a seamless manner. There's, I think, an implicit and unfortunate assumption that all we have to do is provide repositories in the same way as we've provided repositories for papers, and it will solve the data problem. Sure. It won't. Yeah. It won't come near to it. The thing about papers is that they are, as used at the moment, they're bounded in time and extent, so that you have a paper which is the final PDF or whatever it is, and these things are saved for all time. They're unlikely to change and all the rest of it. Yeah. Data is never like that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now, when I was on the website project, we arranged with Crossref to get DOIs for our evaluations, so they're actually going to be citable as
right.
well. And I was talking to Jeff Builder out in Solo a week ago, and he said, I'm thinking about setting up a grassroots blog network as great changes happen. I've been thinking about this for a while. And he was saying, make sure you have DOIs for blog posts, which is something that never occurred to me. You know, these are actually, in some cases, a matter of scientific record, because people are talking about papers, they're discussing them, they're showing you the flaws. That's an awesome idea, isn't it?
Well, when you start working in semantic web, right, and I have been inspired by Tim Berners-Lee's vision for 15 years, you fairly quickly pick up the fact that you have to label everything. Mm. If you don't label it, you know, then you can't use it. That you have to label it with an identifier, and you have to be able to describe it in simple terms, and you have to know how it behaves. So that a blog post, should have a URI of some sort. Now, it doesn't have to be a DOI. Mm. So a URI, if it's constant, should do. The problem with DOIs for many bloggers is, you know, they cost money, and they're an additional amount of administrative overhead that you have to put on. So you have to decide what the DOI is there for. Is it to locate and identify the thing for navigational purposes, or is it there to be a matter of the academic record?
Yeah.
And what happens if the material disappears? Unless the blog is archived, then it's a statement that this blog occurred at some stage, but it doesn't tell you much more about it.
Yeah, and with a DOI, if you maintain it, you're more likely to be able to find it when that server disappears or whatever.
But only, well, you
well,
may.
Only if you copy you it, may, yeah, yes. I mean, it's just like... There is actually a question I want to ask on the video, if that's all right.
Sure.
Yeah. It comes out of the discussion that you had in the session at Solo with Michael Habib.
Oh, yes. Right.
So I'm going to ask you about Elsevier and other paid journals. Are you having pushback from paid journals about making the data that is referenced in their papers available?
Right. Okay, so this is really where open data started, was that I believed that all science should be published as supplemental data. Now, that was a naive view at the time, but it comes from the fact that I work in the long tail of science, where you have hundreds of thousands of papers published, each making a small contribution to the data in science, rather than big science, which consists of large projects where the data is managed independently of publication. So here we're talking about long tail science. Crystallography is an excellent example, protein sequences, another excellent example, and so on. Where each paper produces a small amount of science, which is published by the journal. Now, firstly, not all journals publish it, so that this is a matter of individual editorial policy, I am certainly keen that journals publish this to start with, but lots of them don't. So we need to push for this data to be published somewhere, and I think we're seeing a a question as to whether the publisher is the right place to publish data or whether it should be somewhere else. You've seen the recent decision by the Journal of Neuroscience,
yes,
haven't you?
That
it's not going to publish supplemental data anymore. I think this is a mistake and a pity, because I see other journals who are doing quite the reverse. So I talked to the Journal of Proteomics, Journal of Molecular and Cellular Proteomics. I know the editor, Ralph Bradshaw, and he and his colleagues have been making a very determined push to get the data reposited as part of the publication process. So what they discovered in proteomics is that if you just get authors to put in their statement about the data, you're likely to have rather variable data, and that's probably putting it mildly, where people state what they have determined, what their spectra look like, what they found, but there's no universal check and balance as to what's happened. So the journal now insists that you deposit your raw data, which is mass spectroscopy for the most part, and that this is reposited. They use a repository called Tranche in Michigan, and this is a condition of publication. Now, that seems to me the best motivation that one can get, that the deposition is primarily to validate the science which is published in the article. So I think we should be moving, however you do it, to a way in which the statements, the assertions made in the article are backed up by as much data as is necessary to justify it. That's been done in crystallography for many years, and I think that's been the primary motivation for it, though there's been a huge secondary benefit that one can reuse the data for systematic science. I think we now have a grant from JISC to investigate this, which we're working with both BMC and the International Union of Crystallography on whether it's possible to validate data as part of the publication process.
Sure. And a couple of years ago, there was a high-profile fraud case where someone basically made up a structure as published in Nature with two other papers.
There have been more than one case.
But this this is particularly high-profile because it was... It might have been Science, actually, and it was the complement protein.
There have been a number, and some of them have been spread over multiple journals.
Yeah.
I think that was a group from Alabama,
yeah.
But in small molecule crystallography, there's been a group in China which has produced about probably somewhere of the order of 70 false structures, fake structures, right? We can assume that this happens in other disciplines and hasn't been detected, probably because they're less data rich, there's less ability to replicate.
But will full open data help combat that? Do you think reviewers will actually rerun calculations if the data are deposited at the time of submission of a paper?
Well, that's what our project is aiming to look into, is
right.
Can we actually make data validation part of the pre-publication process? So can we at least put the various bits in place? Again, I use crystallography as the example, but it is such a good one. The International Union of Crystallography have a tool called CheckSIF, where if you publish a small molecule structure, it will review all of the data you are depositing and look for anomalies, inconsistencies, things of that sort. So it will tell you, have you collected enough data to justify the conclusions you're making? Are any of the parameters that you deduce from this out with the normal range of scientific observation in this field, and so forth? I would believe that we will move from that to actually recalculating the final structure as part of the process. Now, one can have difficulties there when you've got very large calculations and so on, but I think that there are so many machines around now that it should be possible to set this up. The difficulty is setting up the calculation, not actually the power to do it. We have very complex programs and data sources, but I think we're going to find that there's an increasing number of disciplines which do require this.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Do you think that, you know, people are going to move away from publishing discrete articles in journals, especially if you've got the data, all the data they generate is going to be available somewhere? You won't have to, I mean, you have to say what you have discovered using these data. But do you think people will be doing that in traditional journal articles, say 10 years' time?
I'm not very good at predicting when things are going to change, so the timeline is difficult. I mean, I am still flabbergasted by how conservative the whole publishing process is and how conservative the academic process is. So academia has done nothing in the last 15 years in response to the digital revolution. I mean, I count from the web, if you like. So 15, 20 years, something like that. Electronic publications are purely copies of paper, which reduce transmission costs and virtually nothing else. They have enhanced certain aspects of scholarship because, you know, you can do certain limited electronic operations on them, but they've come nowhere near digging down into what's really possible at the moment. The academic institutions have actually got more conservative because they've used this as a mindless metric for the value of scientific process. Journal impact factors and so on were not originally developed as a metric of academic quality and so on, but they have become used as such, and we will now see that whatever metrics the publishers come up with, or the secondary publishers, are likely to be adopted by academia. It's rather like judging the quality of music by the number of popular sales. It's a very poor indicator in the fullness of time. Mozart was not necessarily the most popular composer, in his day. Yeah. Shakespeare was not the most popular author in subsequent centuries and so on, you know.
Yeah, that's very true.
So, coming back to that, I cannot see how this is going to change, but I can give one or two indicators as to what may happen. First of all, I think that the scholarly publishing system is under increasing stress. It's under stress from budgets, so that whatever might have happened up to now, the clawback in academic funding, which we're going to see, is undoubtedly going to have an effect here. You cannot have scholarly publishing revenues increasing at 10% a year, year on year out, because the budget won't manage it. So something will have to change in the system there. I think it'll be a fracture rather than an evolution. So I think that if we see a fracture, we will see the types of scholarly publishing changing. And if that happens, then there will be room for all sorts of other things and so on. I think that the career structure in academia is incredibly rigid, compared with what it might be, and that again may be under threat from, you know, the different types of people who may want to be involved in academia and so on. I also see the involvement with the non-academic world as something which is going to happen, so that much academic thought and innovation now takes place outside the walls of academia, that we've got a huge amount of digitally literate and enthusiastic people, and these people will start changing the world despite what academia wants. I mean, I've just on Saturday been at Open Tech, where a large number of digital innovators and activists and revolutionaries met up under the guise of the Unix User group, UK Unix user group, and these people are building the information tools of the future, and it may well be that they come up with ways of communication which are superior to our current ways of doing.
So you're not just talking about things like SETI and Galaxy Zoo and Foldit, you're talking about actually intellectual contribution.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Certainly, in arts and humanities, there is, you know, there is so much creativity outside the walls of academia that it has to, take off in ways that, you know, academia will have to catch up with it. You can't have your professor who is studying a Greek manuscript that only he has access to because of the conventions of it. The world will demand this, and then you'll get enlightened quotes amateurs around the world making just as good contributions.
So are we seeing a parallel development in arts and humanities? Because as you say, there are manuscripts and things like that which people are getting more and more access to.
I'm sure that's happening. I can't give complete chapter and verse, but if you look at the effort that now on the web goes into things like, the history of the American Revolution, or an example which might be crowdsourced through the Zooniverse is the records of ships' logs from the British Navy, where we may be able to extract historical climate data by crowdsourcing the logs of ships which were required to record temperature, barometric pressure, wind speed, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And that's just as good scientific research, if not more, than happens, in many universities.
That's good. Okay. Is there anything else you want to ask me, or anything else you want to say about sound?
I don't think so. I think probably commenting alone, as opposed to having other people here, is a little bit more of a burden and so forth. I don't think there's much else that I want to say. Remember that these are ongoing discussions, so
These
things will. We need to make sure they don't overlap. But actually, this has been extremely valuable. It's concentrated on a different area from what we've had up to now.
You've probably not heard of our posters project at Factor of 1000.
Of?
Our posters project.
So P-O-S-T-E-R-S.
Yeah, scientific posters that you give at conferences.
I'm not sure that I have.
Yeah. We're,
I did look at your site.
Yeah, we I'm not sure it's linked meaningfully from the main site, but we're, it is there, but you could easily miss it. So now we're encouraging people who submit a poster at a conference to deposit their poster with us. What they'll do is submit a PDF, write a little blurb about it, and we index it so it's searchable, we categorise it, we organise it by meeting if it's part of a big meeting. That's all free to access as well, so we make that completely open to people to look at. We don't have the data associated with it. That's probably just because we don't have the servers to do that.
Yeah.
But
so you're acting as a sort of scientific slide share with...
Basically, yes. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
So that's fine. Please make sure that all these things are CC BY.
Sure. I have to talk to the person in charge of the project.
You
might want to email me that to make sure it
is. The problem is that, you might need to record it on on your machine.
Well, if I get a copy of this as well, then...
Absolutely. What you would find is that if Jordan was here, he would also emphasise this very strongly. Or Rufus. The problem is that a lot of academics... ritually label things as non-commercial. Now, this does nobody any good whatever. It would restrict you making use of it, for example. It would restrict people putting it in textbooks and so on. And so you know, we would say non-commercial considered harmful, generally.
Yeah, yeah.
So having said that, I would also, and this is my personal beef, like whatever the posters were, to be as semantic as possible.
Oh, I agree.
So if it can, you know, if people have done them in doc beforehand, then provide the doc as well as the PDF and so forth.
I mean, it'd be nice if people gave us XML and then we could just generate whatever we needed to. But, you know, for ease of use at the moment, but that's certainly something we'd like to look at. We're getting quite a lot of uptake from societies as well that run meetings.
I'm not surprised. No, really, I think that's a very good idea.
Yeah.
So, having said that, I understand your business model, right? It's perfectly acceptable. I'm not a zealot against pay for access. But one of the questions I am trying to explore, and I don't know if it's something that is relevant to you, is how does one make a commercial business from open material? Now, the software industry has done that, so there are any number of examples you can point to where their source code is open, open source, Linux being one of the best examples here, and people make commercial products from it. That doesn't happen in other areas of science. I'm trying to see how it can be done in chemistry, and I haven't yet come up with a compelling mechanism for that.
Yeah, it's very hard to know how to run that and how to make money. Posters, like I said, it's completely free to access. Can't be open because it's PDFs, but you know.
PDFs can be open.
I'm not sure what the copyright restrictions are.
It's the license that effectively
it's licensed. I'm not sure what it is, but it's free to access. Anyone can read the PDF. We're hoping, you know, basically to fund this by sponsorship from farmers. Pharmaceutical companies will pay us for early access to things, maybe.
Yes.
We're also going to act as agents for the faculty members, and like I said, we've got these 10,000 people. If you want an exclusive panel session with four or five of the top scientists in a particular field, we can set that up for you.
I think that's an excellent model, yes.
Yeah. We're also thinking of acting as a document clearinghouse. So an author will pay, you know, author pays, submit a manuscript. Our faculty, three, four, or five people, will review it, give it a score, and then we can either publish that manuscript ourselves or we can offer it to a journal and say, here is a peer-reviewed manuscript, here are the comments, here is the score. We think it is suitable for your journal, and they'll just go and publish it.
I think that is the way in which publishing is going to change, I think, so that... I think that having a wide range of different journals is not an attractive economic model at the moment. Mm. You know, if this were a normal industry, the number of publishers would have decreased by now, and there would be more general ways of saving money on this and so on. There is little value in getting authors to submit manuscripts to journals and go down the chain until they hit the one that accepts this. Yeah. It causes a whole load of wasted work. Mm. It delays publication. It does not result in better papers. It's a simple ritual built out.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that your model plus one's model and so on are that you have a unified place for submitting your paper. And you then don't have to make the decisions about going to different publishers. And I think that that's a model which I can certainly see being developed and so forth.
Yeah.
So coming back to your idea, you submit your... I would love to have one journal that I submit it to and so forth. You submit it, you give it a quality control. Now, in a sense, it's rather like, you know, it's another version of the archive, but... you know, with different things downstream. I would love to see the technical aspect of publishing unified. So I see no reason why we couldn't have a consistent interface for authors. We ought to have a single interface, not all this stuff about...
I was just talking to Mark Patterson at Flops about exactly this thing. We said we want authoring tools. We want, you know, every author, every journal uses the same tool. It produces the same XML, and then you just...
Yeah.
There you go.
The problem is there. You see, you said every journal. Now, if you said there is only one hyper journal, then you solve the problem.
But, I mean, there's no reason not to do that, because every journal takes, you know, these beautifully crafted Word documents, for example, and then fucks it up.
Trashes them.
By sending it, well, in our case, for our review articles, we send them to India and they make XML, which comes back broken. And we have
Everybody
does that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in everyone's interest to say.
So you see, the vision that Henry Zeppa and I have is of semantic publication, that the author creates a publication which is as semantic as they can make it, and these semantics are passed through the whole system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the technology for that is, I would say, more or less present. There are some glitches in it and so forth, but over the last year and a half, we've been funded by Microsoft to produce an open source chemical editing tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fully up to publication yet, but it's... its chemistry is done at the level of first year undergraduate so far, and it's had 200,000 downloads. So, you know, so it's a certainly a distributable tool. What we would see as a model is that when people authored their chemistry, they would use that, and that would preserve the semantics of the bulk of the chemistry. You'll always get edge cases, right, and so on. You'll always get types of data that don't fit in and so on. But the majority of scientific publications in this area contain text, tables, graphs, numbers, equations, references, and then domain-specific things such as chemistry, images is another one, and so on. We ought to have a standard way of submitting images.
Yes.
You know, it's simple.
And indeed, not just, you know, chemistry, but...
Macromolecular
images.
No, no, I meant the whole lot.
Oh, the whole lot.
Your
gels,
your cells, your microarrays, everything. I mean, after all, you know, I can't search the literature at the moment for a gel.
Now, that is actually
a fairly trivial problem in image recognition.
Hmm.
You know, a gel looks different from a cell
to
a machine, not just to a human. And so you ought to be able to say, I want to find all gels. Now, I am guessing that it should be fairly easy to say, well, I want to find all gels which have got four lanes on them. Now, it may be more difficult to pick out where the spots are, but you should be able to do that sort of thing, right? And you may be able to find out what the lanes are labelled as. By the time you do that, you then start to build up semantic images.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me. But the real problem for that is that, there are two or three problems. The primary problem is that... many publishers will claim copyright over the images because they are creative works. Well, they're not creative works of the publisher, and that really upsets me.
Yeah.
They are not creative works. They shouldn't be creative works at all. They should be exact records of the scientific thing, right? If they are graphs, they're not creative works. They are hopefully a standard, unexceptionable bit of data displayed with some data tool. And ideally, they should actually be in an interactive semantic tool.
I mean, you could digitize a gel. Basically, have a X, Y, Z. That is not creative. You can deposit that.
Sure.
Just in the same way the tip is, you know, a list of coordinates and intensities.
Absolutely. And we should have certification of the image type, the rights and everything with images. But there's no corporate will, no communal will to do this. And there's probably active opposition from some of the publishers.
Yes.
There are publishers, I'm not going to say anything on the record about names, but there are publishers who have data publishing businesses, either in terms of raw scientific data, or in terms of abstracted scientific data, or in terms of tertiary data resources, you know, metadata and so forth. And those businesses are undoubtedly under threat for the digital revolution. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, as a company, we actually have always been pretty forward-looking. We don't care about individual journal publishers.
No.
We're quite happy for the models to be broken.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, and, you know, with people like VTech on board, you know, there may well be an opportunity to change the future. And I would go for it, because I think that... it would be an experiment. You know, you might fail, but that's what happens in high risk, high benefit. You can obviously see the benefit in reducing the number of current publishers and changing the submission model, the technology model, and so forth. You know.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about it before today. I had thought a bit about PLOS One as having this mechanism and so on. And of course, both of those examples are, quotes, only bioscience and medicine, right? They're not engineering, they're not astronomy and so forth. And whether it is possible to do it universally across the board, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't see why not. How are we doing?
Which one do you want to get?
I can get the quarter past or the quarter to.
Well, you can't get the quarter past. Because
sorry, quarter
be...
past five or right. Quarter to five. Either one is good, actually. Quarter past five is fine. Because,
well, we've been going, what, an hour?
We've been here an hour.
About an hour, yes. Actually, the other ones have gone on for longer, but there'll be more people here.
Yes.
Right? and I think we've covered... I think we've... covered this very intensively, but if you want to talk about more things, do go on.
Yeah, I've got some good material there, so that's that's at least an article and a few blog posts, so I can use that. So just put some notes there. I think that was all. You know, I just printed these out. I think that was all. Makes sense.
Yeah.
That's great. Hang on. Yeah, so what about funders? Are they...
Oh, right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about...
Funders, yes, sure.
I mean, you said that it's becoming much clearer in their mind that data matter.
Yes. So I think that the funders are now fairly widely across the board saying that data that supports an experiment must be deposited, and that data is there also to be reused by the community and so forth. I'm not sure whether it's enforced in many disciplines, and I don't think we've tackled the problem about exactly what data is. So let me give one or two examples. If we go to climate science, right, which I don't know a huge amount about, but I have got myself involved in this year on the fringes, it's clear that the problems are that the data are spread over a very wide range of institutions. They're of different sorts. The semantics are not... clearly defined for machines. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is part of our evolution towards a data-rich society. But it isn't easy to make one's data available. So I have some sympathy for those people who say they can't make their data available. I don't have sympathy for some of the protagonists in ClimateGate who appeared to be very much inward looking and saying this is our area, we have to protect it and so on, because there was a considerable amount of public funding in there, and also they have a much greater responsibility for determining the material that is reliably used for the prediction of what's going to happen, if we can indeed to make policy on it. So I do believe they have an additional moral requirement to get their data out. But having said that, most researchers do not manage their data in a way where it can be easily exported. And that's because we haven't thought about it, because until recently the tools have not been available, and in many cases still aren't available.
I mean, that's something you're going to have to tackle at the undergraduate level.
Absolutely,
as
yes.
People learn the trade, they're going to have to realise that, science is built on data. I was never taught anything about that.
I agree. So I would absolutely agree. I would teach it as early as possible in the curriculum. How to manage your data, how to make sure it's still there in amongst time, how to make sure that you can present it to people, how to make sure that you can archive it for posterity and so forth. So the average researcher, I think, uses their PC or laptop or whatever it is as their data storage mechanism.
Certainly, or their laptop.
Yes, indeed. And so they probably don't even set out with a good design as to where to put things. It'll be bunged in, and this one will be called Tuesday, and the next one will be called Worms, and the next one will be called,
Experiment 38.
Bio something presentation and so forth. So it'll, and I fall into these problems as well. And it isn't at all easy, because you have to come up with a concept, a structure for what you're doing. But having said that, there should at least be mechanisms for making sure that the material that you have on your hard disk now is linked into the system. So you shouldn't lose it. That's the first thing. And universities are not very good at supporting this. Some do, but in general you won't get central help for backing up your PCs, or you may not do. Let's assume you do, then it won't necessarily be in a system which can be exported to other people in a meaningful fashion. So we in chemistry have introduced an electronic lab notebook, which some of the groups use. It's a commercial one, and if we put out the raw files from this, then they would not be understandable by people who didn't have the system. And that's a fact of life of things like this. It has a database engine in, the things are stored as tables, it was written for a Windows system, so it doesn't run well on Macs. Etc. So this sort of thing is absolutely universal. It is, I think, an argument for increasing the amount of open source that's used in these tools.
Definitely.
So if we can get funders to help us create table tools or deploy table tools for open source platforms and so on, that would be extremely valuable.
Yeah.
To give an example, I think we need a high-quality image analysis program, image capture and analysis program that's used by bioscientists, so that we can capture these things, manipulate them in ways that other people can reproduce.
And you need to keep the history of what you've done.
Indeed, absolutely, yes. So you need to be able to, you've got your mobile phone, right? You've got a gel. You take a photograph of this with your mobile phone, you transmit it like that. It's got the data on. You've then got to be required to say what it is. That means giving your gel a number. That means, making sure there is an identification system in your machine and so on. So the culture of universal unique identifiers in the system is absolutely critical here.
Yeah.
And then you've got to say, well, what was this thing passed into an image analysis program? If so, what did I do?
Yes.
Just to make sure that I have not photoshopped the gel. Lots of people photoshop their gels.
And, so, and some of that's legitimate. You can change certain parameters, but you know, once you start changing the value of the data, then you...
I would rather that what happened was that the raw gel was put out as well, so that people wanted to do any photoshopping.
You know, if you want to make the whole thing brighter just because it was underexposed, for example, you could do that.
But you should still make the original one available so that other people can do that, and they might find that artifacts arose, bands disappeared or whatever because of the different contrast.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think, I was going to ask about electron notebooks, do you think that's the way to go?
Heavily dependent on the field.
Yeah, I mean, I've had no experience with actually using them. I've not seen one.
There's no single electronic notebook, there's no question, right? I think that, and this is asking for the impossible, that groups and departments should have a sufficient amount of of IT support to manage it, because without this you probably won't be able to do it. It's conceivable that you might get certain types of experiment which were supported by commercial tools that people could use and so on, but generally these things will need to be supported within the department. And that's an expense which we can't carry at the moment.
And pharmaceutical companies, where they do use electronic notebooks, they're a backup. They also have to keep a paper notebook as well. So
that's changing.
That is changing, isn't it?
Yes, you're allowed, in fact, you're now required to submit electronically to the FDA.
Okay.
It's something called 21 CFR 11, which is the specification for electronic records for drugs.
And everything's timestamped.
Exactly.
Any way that you could see if there's...
Most of this is about process rather than technology as to how you verified who has timestamped it, who's signed it off, and so forth.
So do they put a hash in there somehow so that you can tell if it's...
I think that's the least problematical part of it. There are standard ways of applying digital signatures. It's much more a question as to who has the right to assert that at any particular time this is a complete record of something.
Sure.
It will gradually come. I would like to see the different components solved. So it should be possible to solve things like graphs and tables and so on, independently of the complete record of whatever the experiment is.
Yes. There's something else there. I can't remember what it was. Yeah, I mean, you've come across a concept, Web Alliance. This is related to the semantic web.
Remind me.
So,
is this the thing that Baron Mons is part of? Yes, I've come across that.
Yeah, what do you think of that? Because he came in and we talked about it for a while until, we've got, in December this year, we'll have 100,000 evaluations. That's a huge data set. And if we could apply that kind of analysis, just pull out the concepts from what we've got, cross-link everything, we thought it might be quite powerful. But...
Things have happened in this area for 20 years and will continue to happen. Now, that's not to say that we're not at a critical breakthrough point and so on. excuse me. Again, it depends on what the discipline is. Machines can assign concepts in particular areas if they're trained to. This is supervised learning. Unsupervised learning is much harder or problematic, where you say, here's a mass of data, come up with the different clusters of information and then label them. It's easier to say, okay, well, I have some concepts in this, and I give you some examples of documents or other material with those concepts clearly labelled, and I will use this to extend to a new set. Right. So in chemistry, we can, for example, use tools to pull out chemical reactions from the raw documents. We believe that we can start telling people what sorts of chemical reactions there are, and so forth. This is all done because it's domain specific, right? The tools we use and the techniques would not extend to saying whether you had, say, a gene which promotes some other downstream process or whatever. Now, the biologists have made a lot more progress with this sort of thing. They realise the need for it. They need to classify their things. They need to add semantics to those classifications. And in one sense, the further you get towards animals and humans, the harder it is, the fuzzier the concepts and so on. What I would say is I think that the people who argue for the strong semantic web have got many decades before this happens, even if it does. That is the idea that you take the web, you label everything semantically, and then machines will start making new algorithmic deductions.
Making
from
connections,
it. Yes.
And deductions.
however, it will be possible to have a what I call a weak semantic, other people call a weak semantic web, where you label things, you give them a relatively lightweight semantics, and then allow you to find those things and bring them together, but you probably will not be able to deduce the relations between them. From what I've seen of Web Alliance, Nolitz, I think they call it, isn't it, or whatever.
Might have moved on, but yeah, okay.
We will see, right, okay. It's very challenging to do this. These things tend to work in limited domains.
Sure.
And I believe, for example, that in very stylized domains like certain types of scientific publishing, publications such as chemistry, we can actually get machines which now interpret chemical literature with a pretty high precision.
Yeah. Did you... I saw a comment somewhere, maybe it was on your blog, that someone was objecting to the use of... Or was saying there was a legal problem with your use of patents from the EPO. That's kind of not to do with the discussion.
The one site on the patent office says that you may not do something, and another site on the same patent office says, download these things, so we'll find out.
Okay.
I'm not worried now. I was worried when I had that pointed at me.
So how did that turn out? Did you go back and run the analysis? Was there a difference?
We are continuing to run the analysis, but at the moment the bottleneck is that I've got to write more software.
Okay, fair enough. That was... Have you thought about how you might push it back in time, because they were just scanned documents? Is there any way to get at that information?
As you go back, information gets worse and worse, right? So that we've got XML at the moment, which covers probably, difficult to say, but perhaps 20-30% of the last 10 years, the rest being PDFs, right? Mm. Now, those PDFs will be, I'm trying to think whether they are actually digital PDFs or purely bitmaps, right? Some of them are purely bitmaps, right? If you have bitmaps, it then depends on how the bitmaps were produced. So if the bitmaps were produced on a high-quality electronic document production machine, you've got a reasonable chance of getting things like that. Okay. If they were produced on a manual typewriter, on an electric typewriter, it's not so easy. If they're produced on a manual typewriter, it's almost impossible, and so on. And there's no question that some of the applicants for patents make them as difficult to interpret as possible.
Yes. That's not ideal.
So we've got to get away from this idea that, you know, if a human can read it and understand it, then, you know, we don't need to worry.
Mm. It's basically going to be lost, you know. Well, in 50 years, that information will be gone because it's not being captured electronically, and that's what's going to matter.
I would have thought, if you take something like patents, they probably have a statutory duty to keep these, right? So until the human race degrades...
I mean, you'll be able to keep them, but you won't actually be able to use them in any meaningful manner.
Well, we may...
Unless technology.
The technology will get better, right? So the OCR will get somewhat better, but we will also be able to use linguistics on top of them so that there will be common phrases used, common phrases within a patent. So if it always says, such as, for example, and you can't read this in this bit, and you look through and there are 50 other examples of such as, for example, you can make a reasonable guess that that's what it is.
Yeah.
And you can also parse it semantically and so on. But some of them, where you can't tell whether the thing was, you know, a 2 or a 5 because it's so badly printed, there's probably, if a human can't work it out, then a machine is not going to be able to work it out.
Okay. I think that's good, yeah.
That's very valuable for us, certainly.
Good. Yeah, I would like a copy of the audio file.
And vice versa, okay. Yeah. So can I leave that with you, Adam?
Yep, that's fine. Yep,
and thank you very much.
I could probably give you the video now if you wanted.
Well, it'd be wonderful.
It's just a flip, so it's a USB.
Okay, that's quite handy.
Oh, that's neat.
It is, it's good.
Just make sure that I...